Hey, everybody. Welcome to Quest for Peace. I'm Ayaz Akhtar. I haven't done the show in a while. I've been kind of doing some crazy stuff. For those of you who don't know me, I am a senior associate editor at CNET. I'm also a dog owner, and I'm a guy who has a young son. My son is about, he's going to be four in June. And when before he arrived, I was thinking, hey, I should really get my act together. I really need to be kind of centered, because I was a hot-headed kid, you know, and when I was 20-something, I would just get fired up about everything. Everything would irritate me. I am very intense, and I don't want to keep going into that angry world. So over the past 5 years or so, I have been trying very hard to figure out, well, what does it take to really be happy? What is, you know, what's life really about? So this is not exactly a light show. It's about deeper meanings of, you know, what it takes to be happy. And I've done a lot of things. I've moved careers. I've moved coasts. I'm moving back to New York in June because my son lives there. So I'm going to be going back that way so I can be a dad much more often than I am right now in California. So lots of steps to be happy for myself. And today I've got a guest. We haven't had a guest in a while. We've got Scott Johnson. For those of you who don't know Scott Johnson, we have placed him under surveillance today with this awesome camera shot. Scott was nice enough to join us. Scott, could you, if people don't know who you are, which I don't know how they couldn't, if they don't know who you are, could you give a little introduction of yourself to the audience?
Sure. And it's entirely possible and maybe probable they don't. So I'll tell them right now. I'm Scott Johnson. I am the founder and owner and runner of a little thing called the Frog Pants Network, which involves a whole bunch of podcasts and a bunch of art stuff, illustration, comics, other things. And I am a father of three. I have three kids, and I also have a dog, and she's kind of an idiot, and a snake. We have a snake named Norman. So that's really all you'd ever need to know about a guy like me.
That sounds... this is definitely going to be interesting because... Scott, you are a podcaster / cartoonist / runner of conventions from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you gotta run this, but you gotta explain this to me. What did you do before you did all of this stuff, and how did you actually make the decision to go, look, I'm gonna do this full time. I'm gonna follow art as a passion, because not exactly. Usually you have a fallback thing like, hey, you have an accounting degree and you're an artist as well. That's great. But how did you find your passion in art and broadcasting, and what made you actually go for it?
Well, here's the long and short of it. So if you could go back as far as you could in time to see an 8-year-old version of me, you would find me doing essentially what I'm doing now, which is drawing on everything and recording stupid stuff on microphones and on tape recorders. Essentially, I have always sort of been that kid and kind of remain that kid today with, you know, a little maturity thrown in there. But really, it's kind of the core stuff that I used to really dream about as a kid. I had this really great passion for comics, comic books, Mad Magazine, anything I get my hands on. Daily Funnies were a thing I looked at every day in the newspaper. I tried for years to get syndicated in papers, although that turns out to be a dumb idea now that things have changed so much. And it's a good thing I never did. But jump ahead to later in life, and I was still sort of pursuing those passions, but not so much the broadcasting side, because, as you know, we spent a lot of time in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s, where it was still kind of the old way of doing things. If you wanted to do something on radio or have your own show or whatever, you would have to know somebody. You would have to work your way up through the system. There's a very limited window for a lot of talent to get through, and so only a few would ever get through. And that never seemed like a viable thing to me, and I didn't really want to play the whole rat race game that broadcasting meant you had to run in. So I studied art and illustration, commercial art, that sort of thing. It's what I went to college for. I got jobs early on that were all about that. And right up until the moment that Frog Pants became a full-time thing, that is what I was doing for various companies over the years. And the last company I worked for, I designed packaging and product stuff and marketing material and lots of digital stuff and hand-drawn stuff, and kind of ran the gamut of what I was capable of with my graphic design skills and capabilities. But somewhere in all of that, in the year 2001, really it started in like 99 through about 2003, I started doing my own comic strips online, one of which still runs today at myextralife.com. People can see it. still, and still updated every week. And that was kind of my first foray into let's create stuff for the web and kind of skip over the old model and forget editors, forget agents, forget everybody in between. This was just me and an audience, and it was just two-way communication, and that seemed like revolutionary stuff, so I had to hop on board and get involved with that. Also in 99, 2000, I started making little MP3 files, which at the time were new, kind of, and you know, we were still in the thick of that whole Napster business, and MP3s were this new mystery format that you could create and everybody could listen to anywhere they were. And so I started making small radio shows and little things that people could download on the web. And there was no RSS or any of this other stuff we use today to kind of distribute content. But at the time, it got my feet wet, and I was really excited about what could happen down the road. So I just kind of stuck with it and did this as a side thing and spent a lot of time drawing and a lot of time creating other kinds of content, mostly audio content, but some video and animation and stuff. And it was more or less just a passion play to kind of do the things I was into. Meanwhile, working the 9-to-5 job, come home at the end of the day and do all this stuff. It just kind of came to a head about 2008, 2009, where I realized I'm doing almost as much work during the evenings as I was doing during the day. And it was starting to tip in the favor of I'm actually getting more revenue and more sponsors and more prints sold and more commission work on the side stuff than I was for the day job. And even then, I was still kind of chicken. So I waited a few more months. And then I finally just decided, well, what am I doing? I should jump out and do this. I don't want to be 80 and look back and go, well, why didn't you at least try? So I made the jump full time. I incorporated the company. And now, I mean, it's still primarily me, but it's again, that 8-year-old kid. He's just figured out how to make a little money at it, enough to make it all work. And I spend most of my time making comics and drawing artwork and creating book covers and illustrations. And the other half of my time is spent recording a ton of podcasts, one of which I just posted like 2 seconds before we started this interview. And I now work full time for myself in a home studio and that we built just for me. And life is good, man. There it is. That is the most core way I could put it. I mean, the hardest part of the whole thing was making the leap, because there was an incredible amount of sort of anxiety and panic involved in that for me. And that comes from a guy who was already a little bit prone to catastrophizing things and getting a little panicky about everything. And I had to really work on myself to be brave enough to make that jump and, you know, to do the things I'm doing now. And all this involves lots of little other things. You mentioned conventions. I run a little thing every year called Nerdtacular. It happens in July typically. And it's a big gathering of fans of the network, and they all kind of come out and we have a big party, and other podcasters and, you know, internet people come and our guests, and we do panels, and there's lots of food and people drink a lot, and there's board games and hanging out. And it's just a big nerdy time. So all of this stuff came from me finally getting up the guts to go for it. And that was a hard day, but I'm glad I did it. And I'm only mad that I didn't do it earlier.
How do you, this is something that I've done reading about, and one of the reasons why I went into the career I wound up getting into is because it was like my passion. I liked tech. It was the thing I was always reading about. It was what I'd start writing about. I just started writing my own opinions on a blog at some point. And I was like, you know what? I kind of like this. And this was while I was in law school, and like podcasting came out. I'm like, hey, that'll be a neat distraction while I'm studying for the bar exam. I'm not even kidding. That's how I got into podcasting. And for me, I was just like, wait a second. What do I want to do out of my life? My folks really wanted a lawyer or doctor, hence the law degree and the bio degree. But I gave them the degrees and let me go do my own thing. When you were growing up, okay, you're talking about 8-year-old version of you, and you basically held on to this passion. Were you ever dissuaded by anybody to like, hey, that's great. You want to draw for a living, or you want to be an artist, but shouldn't you have a backup plan? Did you run into any of those issues when you were growing up?
Yeah, mostly from teachers who didn't get me. I kind of had this love-hate relationship with school. I tested really high on everything I ever took a test for, but I had terrible grades because I couldn't stand the busy work, and I was bored a lot, and I just hated it. I hated school kind of generally. And I don't, you know, that's tricky being a father now and having kids in school who, you know, also don't like school and trying to, in a non hypocritical way, help them do better in school than I did. But it was always a weird thing because I would test really high and do really well whenever there was a test, but I just sucked at the busy work. And I would have teachers who would say, well, you're just drawing on everything all day and that's never going to get you anywhere in life. And I would, on the other hand, have other teachers who would see something more in that, who could maybe see that passion and say, oh, no, that's a good sign that if he's that distracted and that focused on the work he's doing, that maybe one day he can turn it into something. So it was a mix for me. But as far as like growing up and my parents and stuff, they were always super supportive. I think they were always a little bit nervous that I would one day end up in a ditch somewhere scrawling pictures on the wall or something on the cement. But I think they just kind of went with their gut and went for it and supported me and always provided me with the kind of backup I needed to do the kind of things that I was aiming to do. And I never once felt, I never once had that conversation where it's like, well, you better get a degree in microbiology or something, because if this all falls apart, you're going to need to fall back on something. Instead, they kind of encouraged me to push further into creative endeavors. So the fallback for me, and it's true today, I mean, it totally has bared out to be true, was the art side, because I had what it took to do what I needed to do. And there are artists in this world who get paid to make things. So it was never a question of whether that was a viable career or not. In fact, the more computers became more important to design and art, and today they're tied. You can't tear them apart. They are absolutely one and the same. And because I was quick with technical things and stuff like that, it wasn't hard for me to kind of follow that through. And those people make money. That is a job. That is a real career. So they never once saw it as this weird waste of time. It wasn't like I was making weird, you know, music on the street corner for quarters or whatever, or trying to even be in a band or something, or trying to play for the NFL. All of those things seem to be a little bit more far flung. To be a working profitable graphic designer or artist is actually a real thing. A lot of people do it. It's not that hard to get in. Just got to work hard and have good talent and whatever, and you can go for whatever you want to do. So it's funny though that I pushed into this kind of broadcasting stuff and podcasting and just web content creation. My fallback is my art career. So like 50% of what I do revenue wise is tied to the shows and the various things I do with the podcasting side of things. And the other half is all the art stuff. I'm not sure I could do one without the other, to be honest, at least the way that I do them. But I know tomorrow, if all this fell apart, I could get graphic design jobs. Wouldn't be hard at all. In fact, I'd probably just keep the freelance job going and it would be fine. Because there's money in that, and it's less important for people to be able to go to a big agency. Like companies like Apple and IBM and everybody else, they're going to continue to use a big ad agency who does all their stuff, all their storyboarding, all of their prelim work, all their production, everything's handled by them. And that's good and that makes sense and that's what's supposed to happen in that big of a space. But there is so much middleware, for lack of a better term now, where small to mid-sized to whatever kind of companies can come to me and go, we need to illustrate this tech manual, or we need to do this thing over here, or whatever. We need intros for this video, or we need voiceover. I've done voiceover for GE commercials, for heaven's sakes. And I didn't even have to have a SAG card at the time, which was crazy because now you make it. But the point is that there are so many little opportunities that they make up for any sort of, well, I only can do this job if I work for some giant Fortune 500 company. It doesn't have to work that way anymore. So it's funny that the thing that when I was growing up, people worried about me doing is actually the stable thing now. Like that's the thing that easily has the most stability. The podcasting side requires so many dependencies. It requires electricity. That's a silly one, but it does. It requires things like, you know, Apple's strength in the podcasting market, which, you know, they're kind of iffy on sometimes, but it's more important to the ecosystem than people think. So some of the bigger podcasters in the top 10 over there would kind of be screwed in a lot of ways if iTunes suddenly went away. That big built-in audience just kind of goes away if suddenly Apple says, yeah, we're not going to do podcast directory anymore. We're done with that. That would actually be a real problem for a lot of people and would have an impact, a financial impact on pretty much the entire podcasting sphere. So with the art side, I'm not dependent on those things. That's just me being able to market myself and have a presence wherever the presence needs to be. And if that's Facebook one day and Twitter the next, fine. That's what you do. And you can shift around and be that guy and you can build a portfolio and build a reputation. It's actually the stable thing. That's the thing with all the, you know, with the real cement at the core of it. And when I was growing up, I was told the opposite, that that was going to be, you know, by other people. Again, my parents were great, but other people would be like, I don't know about that. And, you know, I had people who told me that it was just going to be a miserable life to be an artist and I shouldn't pursue such things. And I look now at some of these same people who told me that, and they are in miserable, no offense to accountants, but they hate their job at this accounting company I know this guy works for. And he used to give me so much grief And I think he forgot about all that because I got a Facebook message one day saying, oh, man, that's so cool you got to do what you really want to do. Well, how awesome it is you're doing your passion and everything. And I'm like, yeah, well, where were you in 1988 when you were telling me how sucky it was going to be? So there's some vindication with that, I guess. I don't take a lot of pleasure in it. But yeah, to answer your question, if I've done that at all. actually, what was the question? Now I don't even remember.
The were people deterring you from going into this?
Oh, right.
But
right.
You know,
the answer is some did and some didn't. But I listened to the right voices, and it all worked out, I guess.
Well, so yeah, I was thinking about this this world where people live in, and they're like, okay, I'm going to do these jobs. I don't like it. One day I'll retire. One day I'll do the things I want to do, and that'll be when I'll be happy. And they'll just handle their miserable day by day by day, and yeah. I'm a person who doesn't really accept. I did not want to accept that when I was very young. I'm like, no, wait a second. This makes no sense. What are you waiting for? It always reminded me of like anytime I go on vacation with my family, my dad would always make a stand and pose for a picture. I'll wave, whatever, smile. And I'm like, Dad, this stuff never happened. Okay, yeah, we stood in front of the building, but we never actually did that. Can we just take candids? Can we enjoy what we're doing instead of stopping by the Kodak sign in Disney World, which is lovely, and I get why he did it, because that was a freaking expensive trip. I understand that now as a parent. Like, wait a second, this guy dragged four kids to Disney World. Maybe he's, and he's taking this on site, maybe perhaps he would like a record of this for himself. So I have a different understanding of now. Why do you think so many people have difficulties in going after their passion? Because it seems like, this sounds weird. To me, it's almost like I'm driven to do it. If I couldn't, if I didn't follow my passion, I would go crazy. I'm already crazy. So I'd be even more wacky. Why do you think people just decide? Why do people decide to follow their passions like you do versus people who go, no, it's not good enough.
Well,
for me.
I think it's a fine line. It's a very, to use the term slippery slope in a different way, it's hard sometimes to, when you're on that edge of like deciding that you're going to really go for your passion or you're not going to, it is oftentimes a very fine line as to where you make that choice. And some of it depends on how you're brought up or how your parents influenced you or whatever, and how much fear you may have about failing or whatever. But honestly, the voice that gave me the most trouble was my own voice. It was my own voice saying, you're not going to be able to do that. How are you going to accomplish this? Even as, you know, more as recent as 2008, 2009, you know, you're going to do this, and then in 6 months, you're going to regret it, and you're going to have to go begging for your old job back, or you're going to have to find something else, and this will all just be a weird experiment. And I don't know where that voice comes from or why we have it that's so averse to these kinds of risks. But it's annoying because the voice was just full of crap. Like I totally pulled it off, and I did it in a way that was easier than I thought it was going to be, certainly initially. And then I was just mad that it took me so long. So that voice is, where's that voice now? Well, he still crops up and says things like, you're not going to have a good live show at the BlizzCon convention in Anaheim. It's going to be bad, and no one there is going to like it, and they're going to all wish they wouldn't have come. And that voice is always going to be there, I think. And I think it's in most people's heads. The question is, what is that thing that makes you say, well, all right, voice, fine, but you've had your moment. I'm going to go for this anyway. I don't know. I know that I would be miserable if I didn't do it. If I hadn't taken this chance and gone for it, I know I wouldn't be happy. Even though I'd be doing the kind of work that I like to do, there's just something in me that wanted to know if I could do it on my own. And to not know that because I simply was too chicken to try that would drive me insane. It's a lot like you're saying, if you can't drive yourself to do it, it would drive you crazy. On the other hand, I don't know. I admire people who just do what they do and they're content and happy with it. They're happy with whatever job they got, and they go home and they're happy with the time they get to watch TV or spend with their kids, and they're just chilling. Like, there's something about that too. So this driven nature is kind of double-edged sometimes. It's for me and my personality. I feel like I'm driven to do these things, but sometimes I feel like it's making me crazy and making me second guess everything, or making me work too hard, or whatever all these things are, you know, they add to your stress or whatever. And I'm kind of a high strung guy. I always have been. So it doesn't help that any, but you know, simply put, I don't think not live with myself, but I don't think I would be very happy with myself if I didn't act on these things as they've come, and I'd be looking back with regret, and I don't want that.
So you said you were driven. And I never pictured you as a guy who's high strung, because you seem like you're pretty easygoing, at least in our conversations. It's not like
everyone else.
I've never seen you planning your Nurtacular. I'm assuming you probably get pretty wound up about that. Well, how do you handle that? How do you de-stress? What do you do when you got frustrations or you got doubts? What do you do to actually be content? Can you be content? Because I have a huge problem with that.
Well, it's funny you say that. I don't know that I'm ever really too content. And I would actually argue that's one of the elements that makes me push forward. In other words, I think I need it. If I'm too content, what am I doing? I'm relaxed and chilled, and why would I want to do anything to disrupt that? On the other hand, it goes a little extreme the other way. And no one ever can see this in me just overtly. Like I come off as just a pretty chill guy who's got stuff together and everything's good. And for the most part, that's true. But I have an inner voice, kind of an inner demon that's always yelling, just always screaming. Something's going to go wrong. What's happening here? This plane's not sounding right. Why is it moving weird like this? Oh, no, I've lost a pair of shoes. No, you haven't. Yes, you have. Like, I don't know where the shoe thing came up. The point is, there's like this voice that's constantly screaming at me. And then there's this other voice in my head. I've always had two voices in my head. And this other voice is like, what are you doing? Chill out. Everything's fine. What are you worried about? Yeah, but Nerdtacular, it's coming up and it's going to be crazy and we're not ready. No, you're totally ready. You have good people helping. You're all set. What's the problem? What are you worried about? There is a lot of that. I have a lot of duality with the way my head works. And when I was growing up, everybody always said, oh, that's just creative people. They're oversensitive. Their artists are always a little twisted. That's why they cut their ears off and, you know, whatever. And I kind of get what they mean. I think there is in my line of interest, I think there is a tendency toward, I don't know, amped up feelings about everything. And that's been kind of a nemesis for me. It's been that voice of doubt as well. That voice that keeps coming up and saying this isn't going to work out or whatever, or I need to feel like I have more control over everything for me to chill. So that's always been a fight and a battle for me. It probably always will my entire life. And I'm cool with that. I've accepted that. The way I try to deal with it now is real simple stuff, like try to have some kind of go-to getaway things, time with the kids, time with my wife. Video games are great stress relief for me. It's a good thing I do a lot of that with the shows I do and stuff. So it also is part of the business, but I'd like to be able to escape into virtual worlds and kind of forget about the real one for a while. That'll help. I like good books. I like to exercise. Spend half an hour with my son, hanging out, laughing, having a good time. That kind of thing is enough for me. So I try to prioritize those things. You know, family's always first. This other stuff always comes second. And if I keep those in that order, it tends to be not quite so chaotic in my head, and that other voice gets quelled a little bit. It all seems a little ethereal, but that's kind of how I see it, and it seems to balance out okay at the end of the week.
I'm a goal oriented person, so I'll pick something up I want. I will do all the steps to get there, but usually when I get the thing I want, I'm like, well, what would I do now? And no. I think one of the worst things that this is going to sound, I'm going to sound like I'm bragging, and I'm going to brag a little, but like,
right.
I got to achieve success at a young age. Like, oh, look, I got to do a dream job right away. I wound up at CNET. Things are really good for me, but I didn't know how to enjoy that at all because there was nothing for me. That was hollow. I just did this thing. Now what did I want to do? I was freaked out when I first got my job at Twit because I'm like, I don't know what else I wanted to do. This is what I wanted to do. I said in 2006, I'm going to work for that company. And then I did. So I'm like, well, now what do I do? So I kind of panicked and had to write up a huge list of new goals to pursue because I didn't know what to do anymore. And then this is also when I started looking into this whole thing of how do you be content? How does somebody just sit there and enjoy success? Can you made it yourself?
And you're saying that you have some of the same difficulties you're talking about being driven as well. Can you actually be sitting in a room content and chill?
No. I mean, yes. Yes and no. That's a really good question. No one's ever asked me that question. It's funny because I'll give you an example. This is great. I feel like this is, I don't know what this is. This is therapy in a way.
Sorry.
No, it's good. It's all good. So when, let's say Nerdtacular rolls around, it's an event. We have, you know, up to 800 people there. It's all very dedicated to what people really like about this stuff. And I'm very much the center of that, right? I and for good or for bad, and I don't mean that in a cocky way. I feel like every eye is on me, and it's very intense. And I'm not normally like that. I like to go somewhere publicly and not have anyone really know who I am. I like that feeling. So maybe I'm in the wrong business because this stuff just keeps growing. But I also like the anonymity of it. Maybe that's why I like audio podcasting versus video, because I don't have to really show yourself off very much. When I get done with one of those events, all my worries leading up to it, that everything's going to go off okay, that all the panels are going to happen, that nobody will cancel at the last minute, like all of those worries, they go away for a split second when the whole thing's over. The thing's done, everyone's flying out, driving away, we're finished, we're heading back down the valley from the event space, and everyone's happy. And I, for a while there, I'm euphoric, like, man, that was great. What a great year. Maybe our best year ever, don't you think? My wife's like, yeah, it was awesome. And the kids are like, yeah, we had the best time ever. And I'm getting texts the whole time from people saying, thanks again. Tom Merritt's going, ma, it's always my favorite time of year. You guys are amazing. Thanks. Can't wait to do it again. Bat, bat. Right? All the positivity, all the good vibes you can imagine. Give me another 20 minutes after that, and I start going, do you think it all went okay? Do you think I missed anything? Do you think it was all right? Do you think people are just saying that? I start asking those questions, and that seems crazy to my wife, to the other voice in my head, to everybody else. I can't just accept it and move on. I kind of have to deconstruct it, second guess it, wonder if I got everything covered. It's a little weird, and I don't know that it's all that weird. I mean, it's probably common, actually, but it's always bothered me. So even then, I have these brief moments of like, nothing could be wrong, to let me think of a bunch of reasons why things could go wrong simply because they seem like they're going too right, for lack of a better way of explaining it. It's always like I'm waiting for that other shoe to drop. And it's oddly makes me very driven, because when I feel that way, I'm just like, well, I'm going to fix that then. I'm going to make it better. I'm going to do this other thing way better than I was before. Or if it bugs me that somebody jumped on a new platform and has some cool stuff going on and I should have been on that already, well, then I'm going to get on it and do it anyway. So I try to sort of erase all that doubt by being proactive, but it's a weird cycle, and it's always there. It's just always kind of in the back of my head. So I'll do it again this July. I'll worry about the event. It'll come up. It'll be amazing. We'll leave. And a couple hours later, I'll be going, did everything go okay? Was I misreading it? Was blah, blah, blah. Because sometimes it's kind of out of body, that whole experience. So yeah, I mean, that's definitely a thing I do. I'm like you in the sense that I don't get to where I wanted to be and accomplish the goal I meant to accomplish and then enjoy it very, very much. I kind of want to like either move to the next thing, or I want to find things that I could have done better. Or whatever. And I don't know what that is. And maybe everyone does that. Maybe that's just everybody. But I wish I could chill there, you know, just have a moment of like, that went really well and I know it and everything's good and don't bother me for 7 days. But that never seems to happen. So
yeah, it sounds like you do what I do. My brain likes to find problems when there are none. That's the idea. It's like, okay, my brain is a problem solving machine. I'm gonna take on a challenge. I got it. Here are the steps I gotta do. I finished it. Here we go. Everything is fine. You missed something. Go back. Let's do it again. And then basically my brain is creating the problem of there is no problem. So it'll just do this horrible cycle of over analysis, over nothing, which stopped me from just enjoying being somewhere. Something really started clicking in my head when I was hanging out with friends and everybody had a freaking smartphone out and everybody was looking down. We're all seated at a table together and I got furious at this point. I'm like, we are all here together. Put that away and let's talk eye to eye. Let's not tweet this out or put this on Untappd and Facebook and check in. It's like, you know what? Let's be here now. And that actually has helped me a lot. This idea of I've dabbled with meditation. I try to just do some breathing exercises every now and then. Just become very conscious of the now, as opposed to worrying about the past or the future, because that's already happened and that hasn't happened. So I need to not worry about either one, because there's no point of that anymore. Because I see what people are doing. When I see people living through a 6-inch screen as opposed to just with their eyes, it bothers me a little bit. But I don't need to put that on them. But I want to keep asking this. So do you do anything like meditation? Do you do anything apart from video games? And
I'm glad you brought that up.
do the now?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because so my sister Wendy is a is an actual therapist, and she actually does a segment on her morning show where she comes on called Therapy Thursday and does we take a question from an emailer and then we kind of break down where they're at, and it's usually stuff like, oh, my husband left me and I need help and advice how to raise the kids without him, blah blah, or whatever. Not to diminish that horrible situation someone's in, but those are the kinds of problems people come to us with. But occasionally it's other stuff like dealing with anxiety or dealing with depression or whatever, and these kinds of things. And she'll have all these different pieces of advice. In one episode, she had a big discussion with us about mindfulness, which is kind of the hot new way of calling, you know, it's a form of meditation, but it's essentially what you just said, being aware of the moment, the now, kind of where you're at, and not just so much, well, I'm here now, but I'm still just stressed out. That's not the same as true mindfulness. Mindfulness means like noticing the weight of your hand on a table, or noticing how your feet feel at any given time, or the what it actually feels like for that breath to come in and leave your lungs. Like really focus in on it instead of taking soap and just washing your hands quickly and rinsing it, to slowly wash your hands, to smell the soap in your hands and think about, what does that remind me of? Oh yeah, when I was a kid, my grandma had soap like that, and that's very similar to what that was. And man, I had good memories there. And that kind of mindfulness is something she really pushes. So I've tried to integrate that. I'm terrible at it, but it's helpful for me. It really clears my head when I can pull it off. And she says the people that have the hardest time with it are the ones that need it the most, so the ones that need to practice the most. And she says it's the single thing in her therapy practice, and she's seen some rough stuff, man, that really actually helps, that people walk away changed people because they actually implement it into their life. And it's real simple stuff. There's no like quackery here. There's no weird, a self-help book associated with it. It is just straight up proven techniques that have ways of sort of flushing the mind, clearing emotions, you know, that kind of stuff. It's hard for me because my mind races. I'll do this at night when I got a billion things in my mind, and I'll just kind of count in my head, or I'll imagine certain things, visuals that will help me kind of clear my head out or whatever. I actually literally visualize a cluttered table full of crap, and I visualize what it's like to just put your arm in and just scrape it all off this beautiful white table and just shove it all off to the edge where you can't see it. And that was at her prompting, and it works if I can keep my mind on that. But as soon as I start doing it, I'll get to like, let's say I count 5 breaths. By breath 6, I forgot I was counting breaths, and I'm thinking about 2 projects due tomorrow, or a co-host I need to make sure he's okay because he seemed grumpy on the show yesterday, or 1,000 other things. And I have to stop and pull it back and try again. But it's really hard for me. But it does help. It helps a lot. So I've been getting into that. It sounds similar to what you've been doing. And the hard part for me is doing it in the moment. So my goal this year is Nerdtacular is when I'm up on a microphone standing in front of this big crowd of people, my goal is to think about those things there, to go, what's my heart rate like? How's my back feel? How stiff is my neck right now? What happens if I relax that stuff? You know, kind of just the physiological, mental state of being needs to be a little bit more forefront in how I'm feeling during stressful moments, not just when it's the end of the day and I can chill. So yeah, to answer your question, I do that some of that stuff and I'm really bad at it. But what helps me, oddly enough, a lot of exercise and then a follow-up with that. That really helps me. I guess it's getting me pooped and then, you know, trying to meditate my way through the rest. It seems like a pretty good plan. I'm just not very good.
Yeah, I've always found exercise, if I don't have some kind of physical activity, I need to be like walked like a dog. Like it must happen or bad things will happen with me. I'll get cranky. Yeah. People at work used to know if I'm hungry and you see me being cranky, like people were throwing granola bars at me at Twit at times because I was just, they're like, you seem edgy. It's like that Snickers commercial. I'm not even kidding, because people would wonder about me and go, you seem a little bit rough. Okay, you should do this. Or like, have you exercised today? These are like the regular questions people have given me in the past, because they know if I haven't eaten or I haven't exercised something, I'll be a little edgier than I should be. And that was something I've been trying to smooth over the years. Like, okay, yeah, if you think I'm high strung now,
right?
10 years ago, I was seriously, everything was a crisis. Everything was a big deal. And it's like now I try not to worry about that so much, because worry never solves anything, at least in most part, because it's just needless thinking. There's a book I've read. I don't know if you read self-help books. I'm a self-help guy. I was reading this book. I mention this frequently on this show. It's called Don't Sweat the Small Stuff by Richard Carlson. Mm. And one of the things this guy writes in the book, and I don't know if he got it from somewhere else, but this idea of every experience you've ever had is already over. And when I read that, it hit me like a brick. And I was like, wait, that's because you're thinking, you know, I've done good things in the past and I've done bad things in the past, but all of them are done. They're all over. So the real thing is, what do you do now? Because anything you do at this point in time, you're going to be something bigger than you could have been in the past. And I found with having a son or having a kid, like I have to be very conscious of the person I am, because this kid is constantly watching me. He is always learning from me. How does the impact of being a father for you, how has that changed you in what you think happiness is? Because I know, you know, kids can be it can be a stressor. That's the nicest way I can put it. But they don't mean to be that. We have different forgiving abilities. How did you handle happiness with children?
Well, it's funny. That's probably the least. Other than just stupid worries like, oh, I hope my daughter's okay on that date tonight, or I hope, you know, Nick gets home from school on time and doesn't get hit by a car, you know, your average irrational parental worries. Beyond those, though, that is my most, if you're going to find me the most chilled out, it's when I'm with my kids or my wife or both. Kids and having kids, and I've had three, never was the stress that everyone made me or wanted to warn me that it was for me. And it's never been nothing, and this is not me being, you know, weird or forgetful or anything. It's never been anything but just a joy for me. So when they were little, I loved it. If they woke up in the middle of the night and I had to get up and get them, sure, you're tired, but there was something about that. There's bonding there. There's connection there that never bothered me. Spending time with them now is one of my favorite things to do. I'd rather do that than anything else. They are my priority, and it's a huge relief to be able to go spend time with them after spending time with a bunch of strangers all day or doing something that maybe you didn't have that kind of human connection or whatever. So the stresses for me were never, the only real stresses with the kids that have ever really been a problem for me are me just worried about them. Like, I have a daughter who's old enough now to be moved out and going to college, and she's only 19, and she's cute and petite and attractive, and boys are douchebags and I don't trust any of them. So I worry about that because that's what I worry about. You know, it's my daughter. I don't want anybody being a dork. So those kinds of things still get under my skin, and she's constantly going, "Dad, everything's fine. I'm fine. I'm fine over here," or whatever. But, you know, to get a text at the end of the day, just telling me how much she appreciates how her and her mom raised her, or me and her mom raised her, or whatever. Those are amazing moments. And I've always had really strong relationships with the kids, open relationships where if they want to talk about something that may seem hard or controversial, they're always welcome to bring it up. I feel like we did a pretty good job. And most of that came down to we just really, really like our kids. And it never felt like a stress for us. So I know that's not true for everybody. I know there are different stresses and it can be, you know, everybody's different. But in our case, any worry I have about that side of it is just my own, again, that dumb chaos voice in my head making up stories about what could happen instead of what's really happening. And what's really happening with the kids has been great. So I really don't have anything to complain about.
I like your labeling of that voice as chaos voice. That's a good one. Okay, yeah, it's chaos man, and your head is constantly telling you that everything's going to go badly and everything's going to be a problem. It's self-doubt is there no matter what. But I know what I'm trying to do with my son is something that I really appreciated from my dad. I would ask my dad any question. And this guy, for some reason, I don't know when he decided this, but he decided that every question I had was something he was seriously going to think about and talk to me about. Mm. And when I was around, like, I think I was around 12 or something, so I'm not that, I'm pretty, you know, I'm somewhat with it at 12. And I asked my dad straight up to him, and honestly, I meant this when I asked it, "Dad, what's it like to be old?" Mm. I tell this story a lot. He just looked at me and he goes, "Well, it's not bad. You know, they're you know, you get to do what you want, and there are bills. And, you know, I like my job and kids are good, but it's not bad at all. You know, there's things you can't do the same, you know, a little older now, but Right. And my older brother got seriously mad at me. He's 3 years older than me. He was like 15 at the time. He's like, why are you asking our dad that kind of question? What kind of smart ass are you being? And I'm like, no, I seriously wanted to know. Because I've always been fascinated with the brain and aging. And the other thing is my folks were immigrants. And I always wondered, like, how does he think? Does he think in his original language? Does he translate when he's on the fly? What's he doing? What's it like to be somebody else? And my son probably asked me, I went to the East Coast. I was with him for 4 days straight, and he must have asked me about 8 million questions. And every single question I answered him with a real answer. There was one time, and I regret this, one time where I said, because I said so. That's the lamest answer you can do as a dad. It's the lamest answer you can give as a parent. But every single question is to be answered. And the weird thing is, with him, I figured out I don't need to worry about motive. You know, the kid's just asking because he's asking. Sure. And if I did that more with regular people in life, I wouldn't be as stressed. Like, okay, why is this person asking me this? What's happening here? Okay, I'm getting paranoid. It's like that's like I have been able to try to transfer that information over to regular people as well. So do you work with a lot of people considering you seem like you're always in that chair.
Yeah, I'm
with
here
that microphone.
Yeah.
Is it a lonely?
It's a standing desk, I can do this.
Is it a lonely existence working by yourself? You're basically, it's not collaborative that much because you're writing your own stuff. Well, some of it. How do you handle that? How do you handle solitude?
It's interesting because it's really weird. Most of the people I would consider like coworkers, but people I have to work with are all in different states and different parts of the world, really. So I work with people that are in the UK, in Australia, here in the States, all over the States, San Francisco, West Coast, East Coast, everywhere. And very few of those people are actually here locally. Now, it's not entirely true. I have a bunch of clients that I have to visit and do stuff. So when people don't see me on the air, I'm sometimes in my car on my way uptown to meet with a client, do some photo work for them or whatever as part of some graphic project or whatever. So those kinds of things still happen. But for the most part, it is a lot of remote sort of functioning with other people. And I have a business manager, I guess that's what we call him now, who handles all my fulfillment on prints and store stuff and advertising. And he's starting to work with all the various shows in an advertising position and where he's selling ads and doing collections and all that kind of stuff. And also, he and I collaborate every day on what are we working on, what are we pushing, what are we doing, and that could be anything from, you know, when's the show launching to what are we going to do for these Kickstarter levels to how many prints did we sell of that last month and should we remove that and put a new one in and should we bring mugs in with new designs. And so we're constantly having this collaboration. He's on the East Coast. I'm here in Salt Lake City, which is quite a ways away, but all of these sort of tools have made it possible for me to be talking to people all day long. And I do. I mean, there's always somebody on the phone talking to me. So it's not so much solitude as it is. There's some physical solitude happening, but I'm still talking to people all the time. It's never like I'm just alone and I only have my own head to listen to. There's always something happening and somebody needing something or me communicating in some way, voice, video, you know, email to a lesser degree. But so it never really feels very much like solitude to me. And I also work a lot with my wife who helps me with all kinds of stuff. We're always shipping something, checking with insurance on this or pushing this through the accountant or whatever. So her and I are almost like partners all the time. And, you know, she's been a stay-at-home mom for a long time. And so she's doing that. When the kids are off at school, she's working with me. And so it's never been, I never feel alone, I guess I should put it that way. But you're right. It kind of is still. You know, it'd be like being on the North Pole and the only real contact you have every day is with everybody who needs you for something, but they're still physically never there with you. I guess it's kind of like that, but I don't feel like I've been put in a cave and nobody can talk to me.
Yeah, when I was working at home and I was an editor and all of it was remote, so I was at home all day, every day. It was maddening because I have two dogs and they are pleasant dogs, but they're not very, they're not really good conversationalists. And I wound up, that's how I actually ended up in the CNET chat room. And I was, because I always heard about these chat rooms. Like, fine, I'll go to this one, watch this show. And I would talk to people. And this idea of camaraderie, I think, is actually very helpful for people to be happy. And you do need solitude sometimes, but like finding like-minded people that enjoy what you enjoy, I've always found that to be very helpful, because sometimes, let's say, I'm living in Petaluma now. When I was living and I was working at home in Croton on Hudson, New York, which is probably one of the most depressing places I've ever lived, I will say that, because it's effectively like a retirement community, a lot of older people. So a lot of folks who did not know what podcasting is, they don't really care about technology. I'm not seeing the like-minded people every day at the A&P when I was getting, you know, groceries, but it was nice to have this little piece of a community somewhere. I've always found that to be very helpful, just to get your, just so you don't have that alone feeling. It's almost like when I liked comic books as a kid. You know, you relate to the X-Men right away. You're like a little freak kid. You're like, oh well, these guys are they're freaks and they're really cool. And I loved comic books when I was young. I still love them now, man.
Just love it. It's more closet for you now, or what?
It's just more. The problem for me right now is cost. Like, I don't know if I can keep paying for a subscription to something, or the fact I like to binge on books. So like I have to like, I want to get like a trade paperback or something and read a whole lot of something. But there is that Marvel plan, the unlimited thing. I think I have access to it. That I think is brilliant because you can have an access to all that stuff. But yeah, so my comic book stuff goes in and out, and usually I'm reading about peace or I'm listening to podcasts on a bus or whatever. And currently, since I'm trying to move to New York, you could see how I have less time to do comic book stuff.
Right now. No, I can't imagine, given your crazy schedule, and if you're about to move and stuff, I can't even imagine how that works. But some people would even argue that what I do all day is just an excuse to remain a kid in so many ways, because I get to all this stuff is deducted on my taxes. Every time I buy a comic book, it can be used for Comic Dorks and Review. Every video game I buy is used for my video game podcast. Like all the stuff I love doing as a kid, I've subsidized somehow. With both taxes and just general, you know, people sending me things, free codes for review, this kind of stuff. And I love it. The real trick is keeping it from seeming like work, you know, like somebody sends me a book. I just got a book in the mail that I'm supposed to review and I'm really excited to read it, but I don't ever want to get to the point where I'm like, oh no, another book I got to read for work, you know. It's sometimes hard to separate which is which, but I've done pretty well with that, I think. And It's a little bit weird because it's kept me. My sister teases me because she's like, "Yeah, you're basically 18 still." I'm like, "Well, what would you rather be? You want to be when I'm 60? Do you want to be 60? Or do you want to be 18?" I mean, it might seem a little weird, but I'm into the things I'm into, and I'm glad I get to do a thing that lets me stay, you know, attached to that stuff, I guess.
Yeah, that is something. You did say something about my comic book thing. I'm more closeted with that. It's like, no. I like the idea of being proud of the nerdy things you like. I like pro wrestling. It's a stupid show. I enjoy it. I have no problem with it.
Pro wrestling. Nothing wrong with pro wrestling.
There are a lot of folks who, you know, they're like, they get sheepish about the things they like and they don't know. They can't like build a community when you're stuck. You know, you're not letting yourself be yourself. Mm-hmm. I was just thinking what you were talking about, this whole idea of basically you're 18. And you're getting to do all this stuff. What's that saying? It's like, love what you do and you'll never work a day in your life. Yeah. That kind of thing. It really is good. I know I've had moments when I was doing podcasts, or if I'm doing this show, or if I'm at work at CNET, like I sit sometimes and I'm like, I'm really doing this. Yeah. This is my actual life. This is pretty freaking cool. Having those moments really does help. If you are beaten down and tired and you're listening to the show and you're like, okay, these guys got it really good, I'm never going to be able to do that. You know, if you think like that, you'll never ever change something. You got to take that doubt, chaos voice, and you're going to have to like put duct tape over its mouth, or you have to shout louder. I know I've had enough conversations with myself. I used to drive a lot. So I've had conversations out loud with myself. And it's funny I don't know if you've ever done this, Scott, I'm going to, we'll ask after, but when I've heard that voice come out of my own mouth and I hear what it sounds like, the negative chaos voice, I kind of get taken aback. I'm like, that's really negative. I don't want anybody speaking to me like that. Why am I doing it? And when I heard it back and I was like, whoa, okay, take it easy on yourself. You're like, be good to yourself, because nobody else has to do it. You can do it. Yeah. Have you ever like vocalized the Chaos voice?
Yeah, but I never. When I do, I don't hear it very well. But one time, I got recorded because one of my kids was making like a Instagram video or something in the background somewhere else, had nothing to do with me, and I saw it on Instagram or wherever it was, heard the audio played back and went, oh, well, that was negative. Why would I have said it the way I said that? Like, it came out like a different person said it, and it was me, and I'm used to hearing my own voice. I can hear it now, right? So it's not one of those deals where you have this sort of dissonance with your own voice. It was actually like a tone and a, I don't know, not a complaint, but just a thing that was like not a part of me. It was if it was coming from somebody else. And it really freaked me out. I was like, well, I'm not going to, why am I talking like that? My wife's like, you do that sometimes. I'm like, ah, crap. Maybe you should record me more often or something because, you know, I don't notice when I'm doing it. So yeah, I have heard it. It is ugly. And you want to try to not do that as much. You know, I mean, the voice is always there. You talk about all this stuff we're doing and staying 18 and isn't this stuff great and do what you love and you'll never work a day in your life. But the Chaos guy is still hanging out. Like, I don't want to give anybody any false hope that if that's a strong voice in your life, it may be. And sometimes it's just accepting the fact that it's there gives it less power and gives you a chance to kind of squash it more and put more of that duct tape you're talking about on its mouth. Because there'll be days it may pull that tape off and yell louder, and there may be days where you've really got them nice and suppressed, but it's still there. And I've kind of come to a place where I think I'm glad it is in a way because there's motivation there too. And I can get, you know, I get further down the road because I've got a voice kind of pushing me in a weird way. Sometimes it's a negative way, but I can react to it in a way that, you know, propels me in a more positive direction.
Well, I think we've eaten up enough of your time. That's what we've been talking for about an hour. We've been talking about
it.
I really enjoyed this talk because I'm learning stuff. That's the other thing I like about this. I really don't think of this as a show. It's like I get to talk to people about what they do to be happy, and I'm learning from it because, you know what? I didn't have necessarily the most supportive folks when it came to my crazy schemes and what I wanted to do, but I had an inner drive that said, you know what? I'll prove people wrong. That was a different way to do things. Sure. But this has been very enlightening. Let's do the promo thing, I guess. If people wanted to find you online, Scott Johnson, how could they find you, Scott Johnson?
Well, let me tell you. Really, everything that's happening can be found at frogpants.com. And if there is any question about what's happening up to the latest minute, then on Twitter, you can follow me at Scott Johnson. And I'm always talking on there about what's going on. So links to everything I do is always popping out of there. So that's the easiest way. And if you're not a Twitter follower, frogpants.com is where most of everything can be found. And contacting me and all that kind of stuff. So huge thanks for having me on, by the way. It was really, really fun, and I learned a little something too. It's always nice to hear how other people deal with some of the same stuff. I'm talking about meditation and these other things. That's, I don't know, I'm going to walk away from this a little bit excited to kind of renew my efforts with that stuff, because when you know somebody else is doing that, you feel like you're not quite alone in those efforts. So big thanks to Ayaz Akhtar for that today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you again for being on. I'm going to finish the show with something I saw the other day. It's a Lao Tzu quote. I think I saw it on Reddit. I've seen it a lot of places. But I think about this every now and then. If you're depressed, you're living in the past. If you're anxious, you're living in the future. If you're at peace, you're living in the present. And that every now and then I'll look at that picture or I'll read it again, and that helps me out a lot to go, all right, I got to be here now. I got to figure out what I'm going to do. And so if I hope that quote helps you guys too. If you're trying to figure out what does it take to be happy, sometimes just being there is really helpful. So give that a chance. And thanks again to Scott Johnson for being on. We do the show on gfqnetwork.com. We've got subscription links now, so you can get video and audio feeds at gfqnetwork.com. We do the show normally on Sunday at 2. Today was a special day because of scheduling, but hopefully we'll be back in a week or so, and I'll keep putting out episodes. I know there was a big gap. I apologize about that. Thanks for listening, and we'll see everybody soon.